from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
There's already been studies done. There was one in a more urban area that just adding a relative few vehicles, the amount of electricity used in that area doubled. So it's very foreseeable that if it costs twice as much to produce electricity, you and I are going to pay twice as much for our home bills.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Bob Norton, Vice President and General Counsel for Hillsdale College, also former General Counsel for Daimler, Chrysler, and Mercedes, dealing with governmental relations and regulations. We talk with Bob today about the stress electric vehicles might put on the electric grid and how electric vehicles perform in the winter months. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And two prongs I want to discuss today, one on the electrical grid, and two on how some of these vehicles perform in the winter, which is pretty important for us here in Michigan. On the electrical grid, look, we are already hearing warnings about what this summer is going to look like across the country, whether it be here in Michigan, in Texas, or throughout the Midwest. There's warnings of rolling blackouts. There's warnings of spikes in prices. And this is without tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of electric vehicles coming on to the grid. Are we in any way prepared if electric vehicle advocates have their way and these cars are more adopted across the country? Is the grid in any shape to handle what will be needed?
Well, the official answer I think the electric vehicle industry would tell you is, don't worry, everything is okay. And then if you wait long enough, they say, for now. And I think your question is a good one going forward, right? If we are to take them at their word that we're all going to be driving electric vehicles, or a lot of us, then there's nowhere near the capability of the electrical grid to do it. It would mean a massive redo of the electric grid, unlike anything we've done before. It'll make some of the things we did with the Tennessee Valley Authority and otherwise look mild, because every small town would have to have an ability to have a great deal of electricity.
It's not just capacity, which we can talk about in a second, but it's also delivery. And as you mentioned, every town, with the way they deliver energy to neighborhoods and to homes, the influx of electricity, of energy needed, that means a changeover of all that technology there even too, right?
Yeah, it's the substations, it's the wires, it's the towers, it's the what it will do to the commodity costs if there's this demand. Think of copper prices. If we now need to restring the United States with, let's say it's twice as many copper lines, and in some places it'll be much more than that. But, what will that do to the price of copper? And by the way, is the rest of the world also doing this electric thing? And are they competing for the same copper that we're competing for? But there's other elements such as lithium, cobalt. And if you look at the price spikes in the last few years, it should be alarming. Cobalt's up something like 650% over the last few years. It's up 70%. Maybe it's lithium. Lithium's up 70% already this year.
I mentioned that phrase, base load energy. That's nuclear, coal, natural gas, things that can provide constant streams of energy. When you look at the green sources that are coming online, wind, solar. Look, it's cliche almost at this point, but the wind doesn't blow every day. The sun doesn't shine every day. When it comes to technology to help the more green sources, we're talking battery technology.
Exactly.
Where do we have the capacity? Do we have anywhere near the capacity to store the energy that is going to be needed on most days when it might not be available in some areas?
Yeah, that's the reference to cobalt and lithium and the same things we use for car batteries. If you're going to build batteries, some of these batteries they're proposing are the size of buildings.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to use the same elements we're using inside the car batteries. And with this commodity price increase, this is becoming less and less economically viable. And plus the fact if you're going to be using, as some studies say, 2 to 3 to 4 times as much electricity if we're having to power every vehicle with electricity. The idea of the windmills and the solar panels we have now, we're nowhere near the 25% of the current United States electricity being produced by such other alternative sources. And yet if now we're going to go to 2 to 300% more need for electricity, think how many more windmills and that we'll need in order to just keep up with that 25% boogie.
Mm-hmm.
So we basically need to be producing all the electricity we have now by these alternative sources, and we're nowhere near that goal.
If your neighbors begin buying electric vehicles and putting this stress and strain on the grid, how will that affect, and as we talk, essentially supply and demand, the demand will be so much greater for energy and electricity. How is that going to affect, say, normal consumer household energy prices?
There's already been studies done. There was one in a more urban area that just adding a relative few vehicles, because in urban areas, many of the people don't own cars.
Mm-hmm.
But when they did that, the amount of electricity used in that area doubled. The way electric prices are calculated ultimately is they take the cost of electricity, they divide it by the number of people that are using it and the amount that they use, and they pass it on to you and I. So it's very foreseeable that if it costs twice as much to produce electricity, you and I are going to pay twice as much for our home bills. The other good news, though, you should know, is that Michigan now has a grant program. So people who need a charger, you can apply through the Charge Up Michigan Placement Project, and you can get up to $70,000 to install a rapid charger, which sounds great and wonderful, except I wonder who's paying that $70,000. And then it's a little bit harrowing if you realize, does it really cost something like $70,000 to install each charger? How many would we need even around, say, a campus like Hillsdale,
right,
for 1,600-ish students and 500 employees? How many of these chargers we need? And, of course, we don't take the state of Michigan money.
Right.
So is that realistic? Is that the kind of price tag they're figuring it costs to put these chargers in?
Talking with Bob Norton, Vice President, General Counsel at Hillsdale College, also former Assistant General Counsel at Daimler Chrysler. Report in Axios after this past winter came to an end about winter problems for electric vehicles, how batteries lose range in the cold weather, decreased range for electric vehicles in cold in the winter. Generally, what kind of mileage reduction are we talking about here?
Well, it's not just in the winter, but let's stay with winter. So in winter, in a state like Michigan, we all have been the winter wonderland. We enjoy our state. We like to get out and see our state. But while you're driving, if you had your wipers on, say it was freezing rain or snow, and you also have your heater running, that's using the same battery power that was supposed to power the car. So I think it would be a minimum of 20%, up to even 40%. And don't forget, as the batteries get older, they age like our cell phone batteries. The lithium technology used in the batteries, same general technology that's used in our phones, and the lithium batteries are going to have less capacity as they age. Even sitting on a shelf, they lose something like 2.5% a year.
Right.
So as the car gets to be 2, 3, 4 years older, it's now cold in Michigan, you're running the heater, the theoretical 300-mile range is going to be cut down greatly.
And I would imagine there has to be some sort of equal drain in the summer if you're running your air conditioning, which people tend to want to do in large portions of the country where it's hot and humid. That's also going to draw down the same sort of battery power we're talking about as in the winter.
Exactly, and that's been the problem. If you notice, Priuses sometimes have a solar panel on the roof, and I've had people telling me that's great, that charges up their battery for them while they're sitting. No, it doesn't. That solar panel that takes up the whole roof of the Prius is just to turn a little fan that will hopefully blow some air through the car, so when they do drive the vehicle, the air conditioning load will be less. But that's all that's doing is circulating air in the car, because otherwise, you know how it can get so hot in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to have to make it on the battery power, they're trying to keep that car as cool as they reasonably can, because it's going to drain the battery at her capacity.
If drivers cannot have confidence, don't have confidence in these range numbers, again, for whatever reason it might be, do you think the most likely scenario is, as you point out, that people just stay home more often?
I think you started off pointing out that places that are cold, like Michigan, where you're going to need that heater, you're going to hurt your capacity. Are you going to go to the Super Bowl party at a friend's house? Are you going to go to see, you know, football is played in cold weather? I seem to be football focused here, but suppose it's your nephew's birthday party or something else. Are you really going to go see, you know, your nephew's birthday party that's about 300, 200, 150 miles away? And then what are you going to do when you get there? Are you going to ask him if you can run an extension cord out to your car? Now, to charge from a 110 outlet to fully charge a car takes about 9 to 11 hours. So you're going to, you know, have to plan to be there long enough to get enough charge to get back, or at least enough charge to get to a charging station that you've had to calculate in advance.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be near the fun. It's not going to be the feeling of the open road. Surely there's a gas station somewhere. I'll just stop and get gas. It won't be like that.
Bob Norton, Vice President, General Counsel for Hillsdale College, former Assistant General Counsel at Daimler Chrysler. Bob, thanks so much for joining us once again here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, William B. Allen, editor of the new book, The State of Black America, Progress, Pitfalls, and the Promise of the Republic. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to find the show on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for updates, guests, and more. We're joined now by William B. Allen. He is the editor of the new book, The State of Black America, Progress, Pitfalls, and the Promise of the Republic. Also a resident scholar and the former chief operating officer of the Center for Urban Renewal and Education in Washington, D.C. William, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
The State of Black America is the name of the book. How do you measure the state of Black America? Are you looking at metrics? Are you looking at trends? How do you get a proper measurement?
We look at the entire picture, everything in the history of the United States post-slavery. And what we're doing is giving an assessment which is not a mere snapshot of contemporary sentiment. If we took the snapshot of contemporary sentiment, people would be inclined to believe there has been no progress, when the opposite is certainly quite true, and which becomes obvious to anyone who pauses to reflect on what has happened in the aftermath of slavery. Take, for example, what transpired between 1860 and 1890. In that 30-year period, the population of black people in the United States doubled, a phenomenal rate of population growth, mostly occurring after the end of slavery, along with an exploding rate of family formation. Or, by 1920, literacy achievement at the level of 50%. All extraordinary dynamics, social dynamics, suggesting the strength and resilience of American institutions and of the experience of black people in them. And I want to tell you something. I want you to know that that experience took place under the most severe repressions. That was the era in which, of course, we saw the upsurge in lynchings pervasively by the first decade of the 20th century, thousands of them. That's when we saw the institution of legally enforced segregation, Jim Crow, which itself was an index of progress because it was necessary to try to turn back the tide, to put the genie back in the box on the part of those who didn't want to see that progress. And yet, progress took place. It continued. People talk about and remember the Tulsa Massacre and many other such events around the country in that era, and they forget that the people who were massacred in Tulsa, Oklahoma, were not helpless victims who could not care for themselves. They were successful entrepreneurs building a solid middle-class life. That was the picture in the United States and continued. It's what Robert Putnam called in his book an upswing, all the way up through the 1940s into the 1950s. The progress has not turned backwards in the broad macro picture, but because we look at tense urban areas and the really significant problems of crime and poor education, ineffective health care, lack of economic opportunity, somehow that gets translated into the experience of American blacks universally. And they get swept up into Lyndon Johnson's 1965 declaration, equal opportunity is not enough. Which was just a way on Johnson's part of saying to black people, you can't do it. You're not capable. You're not able to self-govern. And it's the internalization of that, because that message was taken up by leaders within black communities all across the United States. You are dependent victims. The government must help you. Well, that has created a situation today where we get a snapshot that makes us think there's been no progress.
William, tell us a bit more about the book itself. You wrote a couple of essays, but invited many others to also join in this effort.
So the book, The State of Black America, is a compilation of essays. I've written two of them myself, and I solicited six others from highly reputable people around the country. And there's a division of opinion in the book. It's a debate. Because one of the things we want to do away with is the constant reiteration of one-sided arguments in a polemical struggle. And we want real observation of the historical facts and the present trends so that people can make a decision for themselves. So within the pages of the book, you see what we lay out is effectively a refutation of the racism with a capital R perspective, whether you call it systemic, institutional, structural, whatever. And in addition, we are rejecting the what has become the home for that poison, which is the New York Times 1619 project. Because that project is expressly designed to undermine confidence, not only in self-government, but in the United States itself, to reject the entire American heritage. And so we've set forth a number of arguments throughout the pages of this book that show the errors that have led us into this cul-de-sac where we imagine things are getting worse and denying the reality of our own eyes. We're believing in fact our ears rather than what we can see if we only take the time to look.
There are a number of essays in the book, as you mentioned. Edward Erler writes one, Glenn Lurie writes one, Ian Rowe writes one. Your essay, one of your two essays, is called Competing Visions, and it discusses much about Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement. You write that the civil rights movement may inadvertently have spawned the most serious obstacle to the progress of American blacks in our time. What is that obstacle?
It is the notion of dependent victimhood. And King declared it himself in 1967 in the aftermath of his experiences of Chicago, where you might recall he went and took a small tenement apartment and lived there in order to work in this labor strike there in Chicago for a couple of years. And he made the observation that there's something standing in the way of black progress, and what's standing in the way is the lack of material support of change in white America. And once that was introduced as a meme, that white America had to change in order for black America to progress, that began settling in to the consciousness of the people and became, as it were, the basis for a sense of victimhood and dependency. And so that what stands in the way of acknowledging the strength and resilience of American institutions is overcoming that sense of dependent victimhood.
William B. Allen is with us. The book, The State of Black America, Progress, Pitfalls, and the Promise of the Republic. William, would you say there are still remaining obstacles to black success in the country?
Yes. Yes. And what are they chiefly? Well, the most fundamental inequality that black people face in the United States is the inequality in the sense of agency. We can say of non-blacks, typically, they experience a sense of agency. They believe that they are capable of self-government. But that pervasively in black communities across the United States, there's been an erosion of that confidence in the capacity for self-government, and there has been an assumption of a lack of agency. That is what is really hamstringing us in the 21st century is the emergence of the sense that black people are helpless victims. Where when we talk poverty, we think black. When, of course, in absolute numbers, there are far more people in poverty who are non-black than are black. But all of these illusions, these sometimes intentionally spread misperceptions of the state of black America are really misperceptions of the state of America itself.
Hmm. William B. Allen, editor of the new book, The State of Black America, Progress, Pitfalls, and the Promise of the Republic, also a resident scholar and former chief operating officer of the Center for Urban Renewal and Education. William, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Up next, Lorraine Murphy from Hillsdale's English Department is back for her final installment of our series on realism. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
Assemblywoman Megan Daly. She believes state government is failing us, and it's time to fix it.
California has the highest gas prices in the nation, and they're costing consumers billions. That's why I believe it's time to suspend the gas tax and put the money back in the pockets of hardworking Californians.
Assemblywoman Megan Daly. She believes in fighting fraud to save tax dollars.
After prison inmates collected $1 billion in unemployment, I helped pass a tough new law that will prevent those kinds of scams from happening again.
Megan Daly is endorsed by the California Professional Firefighters.
We added firefighters and improved forest management to prevent more wildfires. and I'm working hard to ensure wildfire victims recover.
The California Correctional Peace Officers support Megan Daly.
I believe to get crime under control, we need to stop releasing dangerous prisoners and hold criminals accountable.
If you believe, like Megan does, that it's time to fix state government, then re-elect Assemblywoman Megan Daly. Paid for by Megan Daly for Assembly 2022.
At Shasta Regional Medical Center, we're specialists in emergency care with the experience and training to deliver expert diagnosis and treatment to all emergency patients. Shasta Regional Medical Center is certified as an advanced primary stroke facility and is one of the nation's 50 top cardiovascular hospitals and is a fully accredited chest pain center. In an emergency when every minute has meaning and every second counts, choose Shasta Regional Medical Center, your choice for emergency care. Shasta Regional Medical Center, caring for our community when minutes matter.
The pandemic has taken a toll on our country.
The Dow plunging hundreds of points, its worst showing of the year.
A shaky economy, financial strain, all made worse by politicians trying to take advantage.
California, New York, a lot of the blue states where businesses are really struggling to find people. And so what can they do?
Homelessness, rising crime, constitutional rights infringed upon by shutting down schools, churches, and small businesses.
There's a lot going on in the economy. There's a lot of uncertainty at the kitchen table.
Now is the time to stand up for community. Now is the time to move people forward.
I'm Kevin Cry. I'm not a politician. I'm a lifelong Shasta resident, and I don't recognize what our community has become. I'm running to lead with backbone. I'll prioritize public safety and make our community more affordable.
Our local leaders have let us down. We can do better.
Let's bring the North State back.
Paid for by committee to elect Kevin Cry, Shasta County Supervisor, District 1.
Hi, this is Matt. I'm your host of Liberty Unabashed. A new show on Sundays, 8 to 9. We're going to have some good music, some deep thought, and I hope you check us out.
Pro Rehab Physical Therapy and Sports Performance is now open at 3673 Eureka Way. Physical therapists Kevin Elo and Rachel Lang have a combined 29 years of experience in helping those who've suffered orthopedic injuries, strains, and sprains. Kevin has worked with the USA Gymnastics team, NFL Combine, and professional BMX riders. He's also helped members of Cirque du Soleil get back into action. Rachel works closely with seniors and is also a group fitness instructor and adept at returning people to an active lifestyle. Both Kevin and Rachel at Pro Rehab Physical Therapy and Sports Performance are accepting new clients. Give them a call today, 530-533-5030. If you are in need of physical therapy, talk to the experts at Pro Rehab Physical Therapy and Sports Performance at 3673 Eureka Way. Call 530-533-5030. That's 530-533-5030 today.
Veterans, did you know that Shasta County Veterans Service Office is open to all veterans who have served our nation? Whether a combat veteran or a member of the reserves with limited active duty time, you have earned benefits. If you have any military benefit or veteran-related questions, call 530-225-5616 or stop by Shasta County Veterans Service Office at 1855 Shasta Street, Redding, California. This message is brought to you by Korean War veteran Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary, California Veterans Affairs.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out our website, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. Find radio affiliates across the country and sign up to receive an email every time there's a new episode. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Dr. Lorraine Murphy, Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale College. Dr. Murphy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
We continue and conclude our series on realism here with Dr. Murphy. In this final conversation, we're calling the decline of realism.
Mm-hmm.
What have critics said about realism? What would they say are its weak points?
I'll mention two main weak points that critics have brought against realism for some time. One is its what's sometimes called its totalizing impulse, which is the claim that the realist novel represents everything from an objective point of view, that it speaks some kind of absolute truth, mm-hmm. that it's neutral with respect to an agenda, which almost everyone would agree is going to be impossible in a single work of art or in a human creation. But that's what realism often tries to represent itself as doing, and the critique is that that's naive and that it's manipulative, if you like, of the reader. Conversely, critics have objected to realism's narrowed horizon, that it has a perverse fixation on the seamy underside of life, on, you know, the body as matter, or as governed by desire, or on vice as opposed to virtue. So those are the two main objections that have been typically brought against the realist tradition.
What about psychological realism, thinking Dostoevsky or James? Is this more of a modern trend?
Exactly. And this is the strand of realism that points the way toward modernism and that most clearly lives on in contemporary literature and that can survive those two critiques, right? So put another way, you could say it's the most romantic strand of realism, but the psychological realists, such as Dostoevsky or James, will give a detailed, vivid, convincing representation of subjective states, whether those might be normal states of mind or more often, in some sense, heightened or disturbed thoughts and feelings. The portrayal of Raskolnikov in Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment would be a great example, a prime example of psychological realism. And for that matter, almost everything Dostoevsky wrote could be cited here. Henry James also would be considered just a masterful realist of psychological states. And Virginia Woolf, though she's maybe not a realist per se, mm-hmm. Would be a name to mention here.
What were the circumstances, be it culturally or in the writing world, that then leads to a decline in realist literature?
The first to mention is World War I, which is always a turning point in so many areas, literature and art and philosophy and culture. It would be difficult to overstate its impact, though I also think the war escalated trends that were present in incipient form beforehand. But in any case, the idea that a novel about daily life in a bourgeois setting, where the greatest trauma that can happen to a character is some form of infidelity in marriage,
mm-hmm.
the idea that that could be a serious work of art or a serious portrayal of human experience is sort of devastated by the war. Likewise, in many artistic media, the realist idea of objectivity and clear seeing is replaced, partly as a result of the war, by a retreat to individual, partial, subjective points of view. And we could also mention the influence of philosophy and psychology here, 20th century philosophy and psychology. You could mention Friedrich Nietzsche or Sigmund Freud, who tended to emphasize the importance of unconscious desires and impulses in human behavior. And so, in literature and other art forms, there tends to be an emphasis in modernity in the early 20th century on the fragmented and subjective point of view.
Talking with Dr. Lorraine Murphy about the decline of realism in our series on realism. So what comes next? What authors, what texts emerge as realism fades?
I'd love to mention a few authors. One of the first who comes to mind is Franz Kafka. And he's writing in the early 20th century, early decades of the 20th century, and he writes with all of the apparatus of realism. The depiction of setting, the narrator's distanced tone, the bulk of the action, often descriptions of everyday activities. But he'll throw in one or two, or sometimes more, but sometimes just even one or two completely fantastical ideas. And they're just dropped into the realist setting, and he runs with it. The classic example would be his Metamorphosis, where in the first sentence we read that one morning after unsettling dreams, Gregor Samsa woke up to find himself transformed in his bed into a giant insect. And from there, everything that happens to Gregor is realistic if you could imagine him as a giant insect. But there's just this one thing. Thomas Mann is another writer we might mention, a German writer. And I'll mention his Death in Venice, which is one of his great novellas or short stories. And it's completely realistic, but with a kind of mythic undercurrent. So there's a pattern to the events that corresponds to myth that the reader can notice, but that the main character never does.
Where would you say that realism lives on in 20th century and 21st century literature?
That's a great question. It would seem to me that writers writing today are open to realism as one mode among many, or it's sort of like it's one tool in my toolbox. It's definitely not the dominant one or something that I'm going to use across the board, but it's something I can turn to. I would mention Kazuo Ishiguro, the Nobel-winning writer. A lot of readers might be familiar with his Remains of the Day, which is a completely pervasively realist work. But Ishiguro doesn't just write in that mode. He has works like Never Let Me Go, which is kind of futuristic dystopian, or The Buried Giant, which, as in Thomas Mann, involves these kind of mythic ideas brought in. So that's one thing. Realism is there, but it's no longer the guiding force in the literary world. Another trend I might mention is which is quite flourishing today, as I understand, is magic realism. And this we could trace back to Jorge Luis Borges or Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who are South American writers who very openly bring elements of myth and folklore and fairy tale into realistic stories and settings. So you might say this is what Kafka is doing as well, in a sense, but Borges and Garcia Marquez are maybe doing this a little more pervasively. And magic realism has been very influential in 20th and 21st century literature.
Final question for Dr. Lorraine Murphy for this segment and for our realism series. Do you think that realism perhaps is too old-fashioned to have a present or a future in literature?
Classic realism, probably, yes. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that we tend to be skeptical or suspicious of, you know, any work that is trying to disguise or dispense with the idea that it has an ulterior motive. We always think we're, you know, someone's putting something over on us. So that's one reason. The other, maybe more important reason that classical realism has to be transformed to live on is that we continue to be more interested in subjective states and unconscious states than in external circumstances per se. I think we would tend to put the subjective in the foreground as being more important and the external in the background, and realism reverses that. So I think we're still in that landscape where the inner world is, in some sense, more interesting and compelling to us. But anywhere in literature that you find everyday experiences being described and celebrated, I would say the influence of realism lives on there.
Dr. Lorraine Murphy, Associate Professor of English here at Hillsdale College, and our series on realism. Dr. Murphy, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It's been a privilege. Thank you, Scott.
Up next, we talk with Hillsdale alum and current news director at Radio America in Washington, D.C. Greg Corumbus is with us. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Freshen up your home with spring decor from Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage in the Shasta Gateway Shopping Center in Anderson, featuring antique lamps and lighting, desks and dressers, linens and love seats, and more. Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage at 1773 Highway 273 in the Shasta Gateway Shopping Center in Anderson. Open Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday from 10 to 6. Sunday, noon to 5. Closed on Tuesdays. Call 530-365-1399. That's 530-365-1399.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6:05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6:05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
Remember us, the Tula Kids? Well, we're back, and we would like to ask you a few questions.
Do you love TV? Do you like low prices? Call our daddy.
Hi, this is Doug Tooley with B&T Satellite. You know that by not calling the 800 number for your satellite needs, you get local service, faster installation, and most importantly, we speak your language. We ask the questions to ensure you get the right package for you and your family. We do big dishes, we do little dishes, we do internet dishes, we even do dishes.
Dad, I have never seen you do dishes.
That's because I do them most of the time.
So do I.
No, you don't.
Hey, kids, we're working here. Give us a call, and we'll help you figure out the best for your family. Whether it's dish services or local antenna help or streaming services, call me, Doug Tooley, 241-DISH. That's 241-3474. Or visit us on the internet at btsatellite.com.
B&T Satellite is a DISH authorized retailer. Restrictions apply. Ask for details.
North State Relief, a nonprofit serving Northern California communities, is raising awareness that there are free financial counseling services available to North State residents, provided by certified counselors at Balance Pro. They offer free HUD certified financial counseling for debt, rental, and mortgage assistance, student loans, and financial counseling for veterans and fire victims. Get advice from the pros at balancepro.org or by calling 1-800-777-PLAN. That's 1-800-777-7526.
Retirement may seem to be in the distant future, or it may suddenly arrive overnight. At Stifel Investments, we are committed to working closely with our clients. Planning tomorrow means understanding the challenges of today. Uncertain markets, rising costs, and longer lifespans. As a financial advisor of 25 years, I'm committed to helping my clients achieve retirement success. Let's get started today. This is Susan Eastman, Stifel Nicholas & Company, 244-7199.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wayne Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill we all have to pay? The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson State of Mind.
Proven experience, fighting for you.
This is Stephanie Bridget, your Shasta County District Attorney. I've spent two decades fighting for your safety. I've personally prosecuted murderers, rapists, and child molesters, sending them to prison for life. I have met with and advocated for thousands of victims, giving them a voice against those that have harmed them. I am tough on crime and support a bigger jail. Vote for me, Stephanie Bridget, on June 7th.
Paid for by Stephanie Bridget for District Attorney, 2022.
I'm Ed Rollman, a third-generation Shasta County native, business owner, and founder of the Merchants Crime Watch. District Attorney Stephanie Bridget has a 20-year proven record of fighting for the safety of Shasta County, including protecting local businesses from repeat offenders. That's why I support her re-election. We don't need someone like her opponent, a workers' comp lawyer with no experience who will need on-the-job training. Vote Stephanie Bridget for Shasta County District Attorney.
Paid for by Stephanie Bridget for District Attorney, 2022.
Convert your calling into a career at Shasta College this summer. Get a jump start on being transfer ready or boost your current career skills quickly and affordably with a certificate or degree. Our summer sessions offer flexible class times and formats with online and some in-person offerings. Plan a cool summer of hot classes by enrolling at Shasta College today. Summer session classes begin June 13th. Achieve more, earn more at ShastaCollege.edu. Enroll online today.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. We say hello to our listeners in the Traverse City, Michigan area, listening on WJNL, 101.3 FM and 1210 AM. Thank you for tuning in to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We're joined now by Greg Corumbus. He is news director at Radio America in Washington, D.C., also co-host of the Three Martini Lunch podcast. He's the director of the Radio America internship program, which we'll talk about a bit later. And if that's not all enough, he is a Hillsdale College graduate, from the class of 1997. Greg, thanks so much for joining us.
Scott, honored to be here. Thank you.
So tell us a bit about what you do at Radio America. What does the news director job pertain to? What are your tasks and responsibilities?
News director has evolved over the years. I came on in the late 90s as a producer there for the evening news magazine called Dateline Washington, and was also involved in special programming like election night coverage, for example, and then on the sports side, the congressional baseball game. And 2 years into my time there, the host of Dateline Washington left. I became the anchor at a fairly young age and stayed there for the next decade when we moved things more digital. That also was host of election night 2000 through 2008 and managed to anchor our coverage from a couple of different conventions during that time as well. Now I'm mainly on the podcast side, Three Martini Lunch. I host Veterans Chronicles, which I know is heard in the radio format here at Radio Free Hillsdale. And I also produce the Sarah Carter Show. Folks might know her from her work on Fox News. And So we have some branded paying clients as well and produce their work. And so on the news side, a lot of that funnels into the Three Martini Lunch and then other work with some of the other shows. And we also incorporate that into work that we have the interns do.
Tell people a little about what Radio America is. I describe it to students here when I talk to them as, you know, a radio syndicator, which they don't really understand. You know, radio, a content provider, an audio content provider. How would you describe Radio America?
Yeah, we're a content creator and provider in a multimedia way. Most of it is either over the air, 24/7 news talk type programming. On the weekends, it's more client based, but there's also some political talk in there as well. And then during the day, we start off with a host named Doug Steffen, who's been in the business for decades. And he goes from the early morning to mid-morning. Chad Benson, based out of Phoenix, is our 9 to noon Eastern time host. And then Dana Lash, who most people know, is 12 to 3. And so that is the broadcast portion for the most part, and then we have a couple other shows and some replays throughout the day. But we're also really building up our podcast platform. All of our daily talk shows are turned into podcasts for additional listening, so people can listen to them whenever they want. And then we have original podcasts as well. Three Martini Lunch was one of the first ones. We just marked 11 years. Sarah Carter, as I mentioned, is exclusively a podcast, and then several others that we do throughout the week. One is Chicks on the Right, if you're familiar with Amy and Mary Jo, I think their names are. And then I don't work on that one, in case you couldn't tell. But Steve Hilton is another one that we've added recently, another Fox News personality. So it keeps us busy. And the podcast side, given its ability to be accessed at any time, is really where we're growing right now, it seems.
You've been there for more than a decade at Radio America. Your duties have shifted through that time as you've described. Did you see yourself doing something like this when you were here at Hillsdale? What were your career plans?
When I got to Hillsdale, I was going to be a print journalist. I had reported for the local paper in Iron Mountain, Michigan, where I'm from, the UP, and sports. I wanted to be a sports announcer when I was very young. I got the opportunity to do print. Got here, worked for the Collegian my freshman, sophomore, and junior year. Was on the staff as an editor and eventually editor-in-chief at the beginning of my junior year. And then when I got my Hillsdale internship to Washington, D.C. after my sophomore year, they sent me to Radio America, and that's where I really fell in love with the radio side of things. And so I knew that I wanted to go more in the broadcast direction. And so the opportunities through the Hillsdale internships were very valuable. And my senior year, they actually added student broadcasts of the sporting events. So I got to be on the Charter broadcast with Andy Brown, who a lot of folks here know, of course, on Charger football and Charger basketball, and I also did Charger volleyball. So that was the infancy of live student announcing of Charger sports.
Aside from the journalistic endeavors from your time here at Hillsdale, what do you remember from the academic side or other extracurriculars that you might have been involved with here on campus?
Collegian definitely dominated, especially when you're on staff, but I was also on Student Fed for a year as a representative and then 1 year as president. Very involved, again, my senior year with the broadcasting. I was a member of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, and I was a history major. I had largely majored in Dr. Tom Connor, took six of his classes, and was also part of his European battlefields tour literally 2 days after I graduated. Also spent a lot of time studying American history with Dr. John Wilson, who was here at the time. And I was a communications minor. We did not have the Dow Journalism program at the time, nor the student radio station. And so to see where things have come since I was here is fascinating, and I love to see it. I'm slightly jealous of the students now because I didn't have the opportunity that they had, but I love to see what you've done here and the shelf full of awards for the excellent work that these students have put forward.
Talking with Greg Karembas, news director at Radio America, what lessons do you think that Hillsdale taught you that most helped you on your way into the professional world?
Understanding what you're talking about in radio is a big part of it. You can have the voice, you can have the personality, but if you're digging into political details or even just giving the news, understanding simple things and basic things about how government works, how the economy works, how journalism is supposed to work are definitely things that helped. And it really started in my introductory interview. You know, given at the time that Hillsdale didn't have a mass media or journalism major, I was hesitant to really consider Hillsdale, but both of my older brothers had gone here, and so my parents insisted on the admissions interview. And the person I spoke with really struck home when they said, well, it's great that you know how to write, but do you know what you're writing about, or do you know what you're talking about? And so to have that core curriculum of economics, of history, knowing American history in particular, whether it's recent in terms of politics or going all the way back to the founders, which obviously is a hallmark of what we do here, has been invaluable, because when you hear arguments from different political figures or other people in academics making arguments, and you know the truth, and it just, when you hear their argument, it just clangs in your head, and you know exactly what's wrong with that and how to express it. And so a different school, I don't know that I would have had that instinct when I hear those things, and at Hillsdale you certainly do.
The media's reputation writ large has taken some hits, deservedly so.
Yes.
As we've explained a time or two on this program, in fact. How do you think about building trust with your audience? How do you convince them to come back day after day for the three martini lunch, week after week, for some of your, content?
My co-host is Jim Garrity of National Review, and he puts it well. We're not, objective, but we are fair. And so we come at it from a conservative perspective. We say we're going to bring you the good, bad, and crazy news for conservatives for the day. So we're coming at it from a conservative perspective. Other projects I work on, and certainly when I was host of the news magazine, was objective. And the way you bring the conservative perspective into the news is you actually present the conservative argument, which so much media doesn't. So in the three martini lunch, we are very careful to make sure that we actually get the story right. And we'll point out when Republicans make mistakes, conservatives make mistakes. But we're obviously advancing towards and championing conservative ideas, related to the founding. And so we bring all that in with facts and with a historical perspective, in addition to just analyzing what the story of the day is. And so we want you to understand why we have this opinion. It's not just that, right side is good, left side is not good. It's because we want you to understand that this conservative position is more consistent with how America was founded than the other argument that we're hearing right now.
Greg Karembas, news director at Radio America, also co-host of the Three Martini Lunch podcast, and a Hillsdale College graduate from the class of 1997. Greg, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Bob Norden, Vice President and General Counsel at Hillsdale College, talking with us about the power grid, summer blackouts, and electric vehicles. William B. Allen, brand new book, The State of Black America, Progress, Pitfalls, and the Promise of the Republic. We spoke with Lorraine Murphy from Hillsdale's English Department as we concluded our series on realism. And Greg Karembas, Hillsdale alum and current news director at Radio America, joined the program. You can hear new episodes every week on this station. You can also find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon Podcasts, and iHeart. Search for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Email us at radiohour at hillsdale.edu. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
We need all units to
violent crime right
California under siege.
Are gang related.
Criminals set free.
Defund their local police.
Police attacked.
In shooting victims.
Victims ignored.
I shot my little brother.
Ultra-liberal California Attorney General Rob Bonta has never personally prosecuted drug traffickers or violent gang members. He has zero experience to do the job. Nathan Hochman does. Nathan is the one candidate for Attorney General endorsed by the California Republican Party. He's the only candidate with the real experience to keep us safe. As Assistant U.S. Attorney, Hochman prosecuted corrupt government officials and locked up violent drug traffickers and gang members.
I'm Nathan Hochman. What's happening in California is unacceptable. Politicians ignore us while communities are attacked. As Attorney General, I'll actually do the job and prosecute criminals. I will always protect California first.
Nathan Hochman, an attorney general who will keep us safe.
Paid for by Nathan Hochman for Attorney General 2022.
Residents of District 5 in Greater Shasta County, this is Dan Gallier, proud City of Anderson resident and business owner. I'm proud to endorse Baron Browning for supervisor and hope you'll join me in voting for stability and solutions for Shasta County. Barron has invested his heart in the city of Anderson, is our current mayor, and has operated several small businesses in District 5. Barron's proven track record and success leading the city of Anderson can be seen across our community. Ag and local small businesses, public safety, and community leaders are squarely behind Barron and know he is the best qualified candidate in this race. Please join me in voting for Barron Browning and let's
get out the vote, Shasta County!
And paid for by Shasta Vote, informing voters and electing qualified candidates, supporting Bridget for District Attorney, Johnson for Sheriff, Darlene Allen for Clerk, Flores for Superintendent, Browning and Reznor for Supervisor 2022. Committee major funding from Sierra Pacific Industries and Pascenta Band of Nomlaki Indians, not authorized by a candidate or committee controlled by a candidate.
Are you new to crypto? It can leave you feeling unsure of what to do. Help is available. From getting started to securing your cryptos, you don't need to go it alone. Bitcoin 530 will take you by the hand to help you move forward with your crypto journey. Schedule a free consultation with Bitcoin 530 at bitcoin530.io or give them a call at 530-324-5175. That's bitcoin530.io.
It's a bright new day. The sun is shining, the birds are singing, and there's never been a better day to try Mount Shasta spring water. Hi, I'm Bob the Drought. I come from a protected spring at the base of Mount Shasta. I'm bottled at the source. It doesn't get more cool and refreshing than that, and it's delivered right to your door. Yep, pure and simple, naturally the best. Start your bright new day by calling 1-800-922-6227 to order some of the best tasting water on the planet, Mount Shasta spring water.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Common Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide three delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
It's the Ramsey Show, talk radio where debt is dumb and cash is king. Listen weekdays at noon on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio station.
KCNR, 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and heard online at KCNR1460.com. Tune in to Mark Levin, Dave Ramsey, and Ben Shapiro. Plus, don't miss our local shows, including Free Fire Radio on KCNR.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.